Welcome to History in a Year, America's first 250 years.
Join us every single day as we journey from the Revolution of 1776 to the 250th anniversary of the United States.
You can find every episode and join the discussion at pointedwords.com. I'm Stephen.
And I'm Leah.
It is January 2nd. Welcome to Episode 2. Yesterday, we watched the Continental Congress sign their death warrants. But today, we have to ask, why were they so angry?
Right. In 1776, they were screaming about tyranny. But if you go back just a little over a decade, to 1763, Americans were the most patriotic, loyal British subjects in the world. They loved the king. They built statues of him. They drank his health in every tavern.
So today, we are going to look at the year that changed everything. 1763, the year the British Empire won the world, but lost its soul.
To understand 1763, we have to talk about the French and Indian War, or, if you are European, the Seven Years' War.
This was really World War Zero. It was fought in America, Europe, India, and the Caribbean. It was a massive struggle between Great Britain and France for global dominance. And for the American colonists, this wasn't a foreign war. It was right on their doorstep.
Exactly. The French were in Canada and the Ohio Valley, and they were allied with various Native American nations. For decades, the colonists lived in fear of raids on the frontier. So when the war started, the Americans fought happily alongside the British.
This is a key point to remember. George Washington, who we think of as the ultimate rebel, spent his 20s as a colonel in the Virginia militia, fighting for the British Empire, wanted nothing more than to be a regular British officer. He wore the red coat with pride.
In 1763, the war ends with the Treaty of Paris, and it is a total crushing victory for Britain. France is kicked out of North America completely. Britain gets Canada, Florida, and everything east of the Mississippi River.
It was the greatest moment in British history. If you lived in Boston or Philadelphia, you were celebrating. You felt like you were part of the greatest empire since Rome. Bonfires were lit in the streets. Preachers gave sermons thanking God for the king.
But there was a catch. A huge catch. War is incredibly expensive.
To win that war, the British government had borrowed an insane amount of money. Their national debt had nearly doubled to roughly £130 million.
That number might sound small today, but in the 18th century, it was catastrophic. The interest payments alone, just paying the credit card bill, not even the principal, consumed about half of the British government's annual budget.
So Parliament in London looks at the balance sheet. They see this massive debt. And they ask a very logical question. Who benefited the most from this war?
And the answer was obvious. The Americans. The war had removed the French threat from their borders. It opened up the frontier. Their shipping was safe.
So Parliament thought, why shouldn't the Americans pay for their own defense? It seemed like a fair request. The British taxpayer was already taxed to the limit. They couldn't squeeze any more money out of a farmer in Yorkshire.
This brings us to the first major mistake. The Prime Minister, George Grenville, had to decide what to do with the army. During the war, they had sent thousands of British regulars to America. Now that the war was over, logically, you would bring them home.
But Grenville decided to leave them there. He ordered a standing army of 10,000 British troops to remain in America permanently.
Now, in London, this made sense. They needed to police the new territory in Canada and Florida. And honestly, it was a jobs program for British officers who had political connections and didn't want to be unemployed.
But to an American, a standing army was a dirty word. It was a trigger phrase. In English history, specifically the English Civil War, standing armies were used by tyrants to crush liberty.
Colonists believed that in peacetime, you rely on local militias, farmers with guns. If you keep professional soldiers in a city during peacetime, there is only one reason: to oppress the citizens.
So you have 10,000 soldiers sitting in American cities, not fighting anyone, and Parliament expects the colonists to pay for their food and housing. That tension starts to build immediately.
But the real spark of 1763 wasn't the army yet. It was a line on a map.
The proclamation line of 1763. This is crucial to understanding the anger of men like Washington and Jefferson.
The Americans had fought this war for one main reason: land. They wanted the fertile Ohio River Valley. They wanted to move west over the Appalachian Mountains. Their population was exploding, and they needed room to grow.
But as soon as the war ended, a Native American leader named Pontiac launched a massive rebellion in the Great Lakes region. He realized that with the French gone, the British were the only power left, and they were much more aggressive about taking land.
Pontiac's war was brutal. His coalition captured 8 British forts and raided settlements deep into Virginia and Pennsylvania.
King George III wanted to stop the bleeding. He didn't want another expensive war. So in October 1763, he issued a royal proclamation. He essentially drew a line right down the spine of the Appalachian Mountains.
He declared that everything west of that line was an Indian reserve. No British subjects were allowed to settle there. And if you were already living there, you were ordered to pack up and move back east.
Imagine you are a Virginia farmer. You just spent 7 years fighting the French to win that land. You bled for it. And now your own king tells you that you can't have it?
It wasn't just poor farmers who were angry. The rich were furious. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, Benjamin Franklin, all of these men were land speculators.
Right. That was the Bitcoin of the 18th century. You bought rights to massive tracts of Western land, hoping to sell them to settlers for a huge profit. The king just wiped out their investments with a stroke of a pen.
Washington was so arrogant about it that he actually wrote a letter to his agent telling him to ignore the law. He called the proclamation a temporary expedient to quiet the minds of the Indians. He basically said, "Don't worry, the king can't possibly mean it."
But the king did mean it. And this marks the end of an era historians call salutary neglect.
Salutary neglect sounds boring, but it is the most important concept in colonial history. For about 100 years, Britain had basically ignored the colonies. They let them run their own assemblies, tax themselves, and do whatever they wanted.
It was a benign neglect, and it worked, because the government stayed out of the way. The colonies boomed. They became wealthy, self-sufficient, and incredibly independent. They felt like free states that just happened to share a king.
But in 1763, the neglect ended. London decided to get hands-on. They looked at the colonies and said, "You are chaotic, you are smuggling, and you aren't following the rules. It is time to bring you to heel."
They started enforcing trade laws that had been on the books for decades but never used. They sent customs inspectors. They cracked down on smuggling. They authorized the Royal Navy to stop American ships.
It's like a teenager who has lived on their own for years, running their own life, and suddenly their strict father moves back in and starts setting a curfew and demanding rent.
Exactly. The Americans hadn't changed. Britain had changed. The Americans still believed they were free Englishmen, with all the rights of Parliament. But Britain now saw them as subjects and children who needed to pay up.
So, as we end 1763, the pieces are in place for a disaster.
The debt is huge, so the government is desperate for cash. The army is stationed in the cities, creating daily friction. And the Western land, the prize of the war, is locked behind a royal gate.
And in London, Prime Minister George Grenville is sitting at his desk, looking at the budget. He needs money. He looks at the colonies and thinks, it is time for a direct tax.
He is drafting a new law, a law that will require a royal stamp on every piece of paper in the colonies. Legal documents, wills, newspapers, even playing cards.
He calls it the Stamp Act.
Join us tomorrow for episode 3. The Tax Man Cometh, and the streets of Boston explode into riots. We are going to meet the Sons of Liberty and hear the phrase that becomes the motto of the revolution. You can find every episode at pointedwords.com. And this is our story. Please note A, I assist in the recording and research of this podcast.